coup attempts in Venezuela. Emma Berger's many articles focusing on Western media coverage of the Americas can be found at fair.org, Counterpunch, Telesur English, and ZCOM, among other places. Welcome back to the program, Joe.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'd like to quickly mention Mint Press News because they actually have an article I wrote in February about Ecuador.
Yeah, of course. And Mint Press is fantastic. What are they, mintpress.com?
Yeah, I think it's mintpressnews.com. They're pretty easy. If you Google them, Mint Press News, they're easy to find.
And yeah, well, getting less easy. They've been there's been efforts to shut them down for quite a while, ongoing now. Sure. Well, Joe, back to Ecuador. Now, firstly, Joe, who is or was Pedro Briones?
He was the president of the Citizens Revolution RC5 party, but in the provincial, at the provincial level, for the province of Esmeraldas. So he was a leader of the party. He was gunned down, and that party's also in recent months had other local candidates assassinated, and. There was another mayor of the third largest city of Manta who was assassinated. Now, he was not with the RC5 party, but again, the violence in Ecuador is just completely out of control. It's quadrupled the homicide rate since 2017. It's affected all the political parties, but there's the Villavicencio assassination stands out because it was the first time in recent memory that anyone can recall a presidential candidate and this close to elections being assassinated. Now he wasn't a leading candidate; he was probably fourth or fifth, but he was still a prominent political actor in Ecuador running for president and assassinated. That's not something that Ecuadorians are accustomed to seeing.
Guillaume Long has said that the right political factions in Ecuador blamed Villavicencio's assassination on leftist forces. He says that they are attempting to weaponize the assassination. Is there any connection that you're aware of, Joe, that the assassination of Pedro Briones was connected to the assassination last week of Villavicencio?
It's hard to make those conclusions sometimes. Every case is different, and the violence is so out of control that it's catching everybody. I mean, you have this spiraling violence that's caught so many people. My own family in Ecuador, they're not political at all. They've had to go into hiding in some cases because people are trying to extort money from them. They think they're vulnerable, older people living by themselves, and it's touched everybody's lives in Ecuador. It's just so out of control right now. So I wouldn't make any conclusions about the Briones assassination. About Villavicencio's, though, the people in charge of his security were the government of Ecuador. The police provided official security to Villavicencio, and they made horrendous errors. The fact that he was escorted out of the main entrance into a non-bulletproof car, and just the fact that one of the perpetrators. Was instead of being taken to a hospital, he was wounded in the ensuing shootout during the assassination. Instead of being taken to a hospital to save his life so he could testify and get down, you know, and help, they just took him to a police station and just let him die. A lot of Vicencio's family pointed the finger directly at the Lasso government.
Well, and Pedro Briones is a member, the Citizen Revolution Party is Correa's party. Correa, I guess for people who don't know, is living in self-imposed exile in Belgium, has been for many years now.
I would just be self-imposed because he actually has political asylum in Belgium. Interpol has rejected three different extradition requests that Ecuador has made for Correa just on human rights grounds. And Interpol, as we know, is not a left-wing organization. The cases against Correa are really trumped up and absurd. He's in exile because of he actually got political asylum because the cases in Belgium, because the police cases in Ecuador are so absurd.
Okay, yeah, I don't want to labor the point, but he did leave of his own free will before the charges. It's more convoluted. But yeah. You did a long thread on Twitter about and I'm looking at the graph right in front of me right now about the spike in violence since Correa's party left power. It's an extraordinary leap. Can we lay this all at the feet of the neoliberalismo coming back into power there?
Oh, of course. Well, I mean, you know, it's really been their record. If you look at that graph, it traces the homicide rate, that particular graph, all the way from 84. But if you look, there's other graphs going back to 80. It basically shows 1980. It shows that for the past 43 years, there's been an upward trend always in homicide rate. Pretty much always when the right wing was in power, always. There was one government where there was a very slight decline, but it was not very significant. The only government in the past 43 years where you see the real decline in the homicide rate, and it was dramatic. It was 2/3 reduction, was the 10 years that Rafael Correa was in office. The policies that led to that are they're multifaceted. It involved a whole lot of different things, including poverty reduction, including cleaning up the police, including working with communities and convincing like urban youth to, even if they're officially affiliated with gangs, to go away from violence and become more like legitimate cultural organizations, and even political to some extent. So all those policies were and actually they go into the policies that the one thread I did, it's based on a paper that was commissioned by the Inter-American Development Bank, because they were looking at studying these policies because they were so dramatically successful. I mean, the homicide rate went from like 18, it peaked at 18 deaths per 100,000 in the very early years of Correa's government, like around 2011, and then by about 2016 or so, it had gone all the way back down to down to like 5.8 per 100. And that's roughly the level that you get in countries like Canada and the US. So it just became a very safe country. During those years, I traveled all over Ecuador by road. I mean, because the roads were so drastically improved and trips could be made much more easily, you know, with no fear whatsoever. No fear of being assaulted or robbed or never mind, subjected to violence. I mean, it was a very tranquil time, and it's all been destroyed. I mean, the right wing that's taken over since 2016 has just rolled back everything. They defund the state. You know, they get rid of ministries, focus this. So the attention to detail on the policies isn't there. The police have just been allowed to get taken over by all kinds of criminal elements, and that's why there's been prison massacres and just horrific what they've done, and the increase in poverty also doesn't help too. There's definitely been like a 17% increase in poverty as well since 2017. So it's a whole bunch of things, but it's just basically the negligence, and also, you know, when the crime gets bad, what does the right wing want to do? They want to say, well, it's you know, too many civil rights. It's because we don't have enough guns, or we need the death penalty. We need to extradite people. You know, they have all the typical solutions that involve basically making the state more brutal instead of more effective.
The political forces on both sides in Ecuador right now in this presidential election, they're all blaming gang violence and corruption in the state, the crossover of gangs, the involvement of gangs with government and police forces. Villavicencio himself had come out and said he was going to, you know, clean up the police forces. And Luisa Gonzalez, who is from one poll at least, and maybe you can clear up this for me, is the favorite in the presidential election right now. She, from the Citizens Revolution Party of Pedro Briones and Rafael Correa. So it's an easy thing to sort of push everything onto the gangs and organized violence. And they've been blamed for all of these assassinations as well. But there are these weird anomalies with Villavicencio's security detail. And I recall reading somewhere years ago that when there's a political assassination or a high profile killing in this manner, you look at how security failed and how it was designed to fail. And in this case of Villavicencio, there's a lot of red flags involved. And one of the more interesting ones that I saw was that the assassination team is reported to be a, as in Haiti with the assassination of President Moise, is there from Colombia. Has that been borne out?
Yeah, it's been widely reported that they're Colombians. You know, the thing with gangs, yes, there should be some care made there. Like, whenever there's urban youth organized in, you know, poor people basically organized in any fashion, especially if they're young, you know, it's easy to vilify them and demonize them as gangs. So, you know, which makes the assumption that they're just violence, they're just thugs. But mind you, if the state doesn't give them a positive option, and that's the point of American Development Bank's paper, is that the effective policing has to involve the community. It's not just about giving the cops better. I mean, they have to have proper equipment and radios and all the technology and stuff, but they also have to have links with the community and be trusted with by the community that they're not just like an occupation force, you know. So they have to, give people a positive outlet for, you know, positive engagement with the police. So that's part of what Correa enacted. So there were gangs that were effectively so-called gangs that were effectively legalized, that are decriminalized, should I say? Like they were brought into, like they were told to interact with the state in a positive way, and as long as they weren't engaged in violence or criminal activity, then they weren't criminalized, they weren't targeted. So that was an important aspect there. That means one aspect of how we had this dramatic reduction in homicide rate. But it also has to do with economic policies, obviously, because if there's if job opportunities are becoming more available, anti-poverty programs are more available, then that obviously diminishes the incentive to turn to criminal activity. But yeah, you're right. When there's like an assassination, like the Villavicencio thing, obviously he was a high profile candidate, somebody who was obviously at high risk of being assassinated, as all the candidates are in today's Ecuador, because there's all kinds of people who have an interest in for various reasons of stirring up chaos and fear. So yeah, you have to look at the police, obviously. But I mean, when you have prison riots out of control, that it tells you that there's elements of the states that are being corrupted, are looking the other way, and letting criminals settle score among themselves. So you definitely have a criminal element that's infiltrated the police. And that's a huge problem. I mean, one of the reforms that brought down homicide rate, and I wrote about this before, is that Correa's government brought in polygraph tests for police applicants. So they could ask them questions like, yeah, would you take a bribe? Do you know people who have taken bribes? You know, basically put the questions that really put them on the spot, and they could filter out a huge number of candidates that way who they knew were not like people who should not be in uniform. So there's all sorts of it's multifaceted, and that's what it has to do with so many factors to reduce the homicide rate. And they were successful, and now it's been dismantled, and we have now this problem of political assassinations, even which was unheard of before.
In your thread on Twitter or X, on the Inter-American Development Bank paper, this is from 2018, and as you're just saying, I found it fascinating when you say, and I'll quote you: "Emerging from a clandestine organization and being formally recognized by the state meant that these gangs, or formerly known as gangs, right, could dress in their own colors, so to speak, and come out of the shadows, be in public spaces, and then be included in the debate."
Right. It's basically just trying to decriminalize young people from poor neighborhoods who just organize among themselves. I mean, anyone who organizes among themselves, they can do it for bad things or for constructive things. It depends where the incentives are, and that was one aspect of a successful crime reduction policy. But to be sustained, they had to keep up the resources and the attention to the just so many factors that had to be sustained, the economic policies, and everything was just dismantled. Everything went in the exact opposite direction over the past 6 years, and it shows. And again, the point I want to make is that there's never been really a right-wing government with a good record on crime in Ecuador in the past 43 years. Some have been worse than others, but none of them have been good. None of them have achieved anything like what Correa achieved in the 10 years that his government was in office.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in a second. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Joe Emmonsberger. Joe's a Canadian Ecuadorian. He's an engineer. He's a journalist, co-author with Justin Potter of the book Extraordinary Threat, the U.S. Empire, the Media, and 20 Years of Coup Attempts in Venezuela. His articles can be found at FAIR, Counterpunch, Telestor English, ZCOM, and most importantly, perhaps, Mint Press News. You check them out. They do excellent work. So setting the whole stage for this, outgoing president, Guillermo Lasso, he did the nuclear option, like the political nuclear option, and dissolved the parliament. But that provided him the ability to essentially rule by decree. And when you're talking about the Correa was the boogeyman to the right, and they were busy undoing every policy that he had written. Well, in this period since last May, Lasso has been a man on a mission, it seems to me, at least practicing a scorched earth on the progressive policies of Correa.
Yeah, you know, the only check on him has been the Constitutional Court, which was illegally fired and replaced in 2018, the total constitutional way. Despite that, though, he has clashed with the Constitutional Court. So he has actually not done as much damage as he probably wanted to. My theory is that the Constitutional Court kind of sees the writing on the wall and can't be 100% sure that they're going to have the impunity that they had in previous years, you know, when basically the Correismo was on the run, they were being so heavily persecuted and the right still had hope that they could basically annihilate them and just remove them from the political scene in Ecuador. That obviously hasn't happened. I mean, there's nobody, absolutely, no matter how much they despise Correismo and Luisa Gonzalez, the candidate of Correismo for president, no matter how much they despise her, there's really nobody who disputes right now that she's going to come in first in the first round. The only question is, will she get enough to prevail, to win the presidency outright in the first round or not? But nobody's disputing that. I've seen nobody is predicting that she won't come in first. So who knows? Will she get 30%, 40%? We don't know. We'll have to see. There's so many things that happened, and polls aren't really allowed in the week or so before the election. So we'll have to see what happens. You know, a lot can happen. But last election, 2021, Andres Arauz got 32% in the first round. Now conditions are worse, so the government that ended up prevailing, Vlasov's government, and in the elections in 2021 is so deeply discredited that, you know, and Correismo is coming off a very strong performance in the local elections in February. So my guess is that she gets at least 32% in the first round this time, hopefully much more, but I think that she's not, I'd be very surprised if she does any lower than that.
And what kind of policies is she promising, Luisa Gonzalez? Is she going to be a progressive in cut from the mold of Correa, or are we looking at another Lenin Moreno or worse?
Well, she's been. I mean, one thing about the Correaists in the present day is that to be a Correaist in 2017, when Moreno was pretty easy because there was no real persecution and didn't seem to be on the horizon. But when he betrayed the movement, he immediately moved into persecution mode, immediately throw Jorge Glass. It was obvious that he was going to go at an all out war against his own movement. So the people who are in the movement after these 6 years of persecution, it actually takes guts to be part of a movement that at that level now. I mean, and now just to be a candidate at all because of the danger. So Luisa, she's a very, very loyal Correaist. I don't see that happening. And she's also, her campaign is even more than Arauz's last in 2021, even more than Arauz's. She's stressing the track record of Correismo, her links to Correa, appearing with Correa in her spots jointly, so those kind, all those indications are is that look, her basic message is we've fixed the country before and we can do it again, and that's her message, you know. And so yeah, I'm confident that if she prevails, she'll work closely with Correa, with all of his team, really, that brought about these achievements and strive to do it again.
Well, and she'll have to deal with the IMF, something that Lenin Moreno threw Ecuador back into the mouth of the International Monetary Fund, now indebting the country once again to the international usury. What about what would her victory mean for Rafael Correa? Would the charges against him perhaps be swept away?
But, well, the charges are already collapsing internationally. Like Jorge, for example, the Jorge Glass was in prison for over five years, yeah. And the star witness in the case against him was this corrupt Odebrecht executive. Odebrecht is a multinational based in Brazil, and he gave testimony. Written testimony that Glass was not allowed in his trial to cross-examine. His team could not cross-examine this star witness of theirs. It was so cooked up. And recently, a judge in Brazil squashed that evidence, say that this evidence is should not have been used in Ecuador's case, should not be and can't be used in Brazil. And so he basically the ruling basically declared the whole case a sham, because that was their star witness. And we saw what happened with Lula. Eventually these things collapsed. And so that Correa, I think it, like I said, if Luisa Gonzalez gets back into office, there's also going to be a lot less pressure on the judiciary to hold up these corrupt rulings. And I think we kind of see a hint of that in the way that Lasso is not getting the free hand from the Constitutional Court that he expected. So it seems like they're shifting forces, and so hopefully that'll help resolve the situation. But Rafael Correa and Luisa Gonzalez have been adamant that there's not going to be any pardon issued. They're insisting this is going to work itself out through the courts. So the message there is that they're going to clean up the judiciary to the point where they're going to have to recognize that the bogus cases are actually bogus cases, and we already see that they're collapsing in other countries as well.
There's an article I'm looking at from CEPR by Jake Johnston and Ivana Vasic Lalovic. It's Ecuador, a decade of progress undone. And at the bottom of their executive summary, they say, and I'll quote them, in a context of slower global growth and increasing poverty, the effects of Moreno and Lasso's dismantling of prior institutional reforms and economic policies are becoming harder to ignore. What has that done for the political environment within Ecuador? You mentioned Andres Arauz went to two ballots and he lost out, quite surprisingly, I would argue, the last go around. Is there a chance that Luisa Gonzalez could win in a first ballot? I mean, have the failures of the Moreno and Lasso governments polarized the country enough that a single ballot victory is possible?
Yeah, it's possible. You know, we don't know, because we can't know for sure, but it's definitely possible. Polls are not terribly reliable. I mean, just to give you an example, in February, Sedatos, which is one of the main pollsters in Ecuador, they were predicting that Lasso's referendum would pass. He proposed 8 referendum questions in February, and Sedatos predicted that they would pass, that they would all pass, and that a lot of them would pass by a wide margin. And what happened? Well, the exact opposite of what they said. Mm-hmm. Every single question failed, and a lot of them failed by like double digits. So the polls are unreliable. Let's put it that way. So we can't put much stock in the polls. Well, that's why I said, what did Andres Arauz get last time in 2021? He got 32%. So I think that's, I mean, if I'm forced me to bet, I don't like to bet on anything, but if you forced me to bet, I would bet Luisa Gonzalez probably gets like 32% or more. So she maybe, who knows? We could be surprised that she'll get more than she needs for the first round win, or maybe she'll get, you know, I mean, you never know. I mean, she could get less than what I think she'll get. But I think the most probable, most reasonable thing is that she'll get at least 32% of the vote. And then, well, if it goes to a runoff, then we'll have to see what happens. There's conditions are worse, but then there's also, we can see how the right exploits fear and hatred and all these other things. And so there's a lot of other factors too, and persecution as well. I mean, like I say, Correa is not even allowed to run. His image is not even allowed to appear on TV spots. So there's still, and they're having to run. They can't run Correa directly. Voters are not allowed to choose Correa directly, where I think this would be a cakewalk for them. But they have to go, as you can. When you go with somebody who's not Correa, then there's always questions. Well, is she going to be as good as he is? Is she really going to be loyal to him? Those things are somewhat of a factor.
Has Correa weighed in? Has he expressed any thoughts at all, or is he standing back out of the way of this?
Oh, no, he's campaigning 100% with Luisa, 100%. He's totally on board. Like I said, they're appearing together in spots. He can't appear in on TV or on campaign spots, but he's on Twitter and everywhere he can, and even doing interviews. In fact, for the first time in years, they had a pretty big outlet in Ecuador that actually interviewed him. So, and that's pretty surprising, because they've really tried hard to basically black him out in Ecuador. But he's 100%, 100% behind Luisa, and he's still 100% behind the party. And Luisa Gonzalez has said 100%, like, he will be my top advisor. So, I mean, she is running 100% on Correa's record and on her closeness, not just with Correa, but the whole team that he had in over his 10 years in office. So, you know, but it's still, no matter what, it's not Correa. I mean, Correa has a certain, I would say, a talent that if you don't know Ecuador, like, you watch him in interviews and he really isn't a class by himself. I would think maybe only Chavez had that kind of charisma, that kind of easy, effortless manner of dealing with the media, with dealing with interviews, dealing with, like, thinking. I mean, he's very, very good on that. He's good on a lot of things, but that is especially where he shines. So it's very hard to replicate that with another candidate, even no matter how smart they are in or whatever. But he has that kind of charisma that's always helped him tremendously.
Well, that's high praise comparing him with Chavez. Do I remember right, though, that El Rose did exactly the opposite, that as you described Luis Gonzalez, and he tried to distance himself from Correa, am I remembering that right?
That was the second round. Yeah. In the second round, I think some of the advisors, they had kind of a bit of a chaotic problem. Like, there's a dilemma that, you know, a guy like Arauz, a guy like, you know, a person like a woman like Luisa Gonzalez, you know, they're none of them during Correa's 10 years in office, the most prominent people. Well, I mean, Moreno was a traitor, Glass thrown in jail, Ricardo Patiño, another high prominent minister under Correa, he's exiled in Mexico. Gabriela Rivandería, one of the most popular politicians, exiled in Mexico. So they really went after them hard, not just against Correa and against anybody who could probably, you know, had a higher profile during his government. So they've been forced to run with lower profile members of his team, like Arauz, like Gonzalez. The problem with that is they don't really have their own connection to the people yet. They don't have their own identity, if you will. That can be a problem. I mean, there's a reason that they've done all that. They know that that's a stumbling block. So they've put that stumbling block in their way. So, yeah, we'll have to see whether they can overcome it this time. I would think they should, given how horrible things are. But the effects of propaganda and everything else has an impact. So, and just straight up persecution too, limiting, continuously vilifying Correismo for the past 6 years. But mind you, in spite of all that, they are still doing extremely well. There's no, and nobody doubts they're going to win the first round, and that they have an extremely good chance of getting back into office.
Well, and the nature of the media has changed as well, not just in Ecuador, but everywhere. And I'm looking at Rafael Correa's Twitter page, but he's got a poster up for Luisa Gonzalez, and she's looking very stern and determined under the, forgive my Spanish, but under the logo of El Resurgir, Resurgir de la Patria, which I imagine means the return of the state.
Resurgence of the motherland, the resurgence of the motherland. Yeah, that's technically, strictly speaking, yeah, that's what it means. But yeah, it means we're coming back. You know, we're going to rebuild the state, and so that's her. I mean, she has no choice but to run as a Correa loyalist, because, you know, that's what she is. But also, that's her, like I said, she has no independent political capital. Now, if she becomes a president, an effective one, she'll have her own political capital, that's, you know, she'll her own identification with the people, right? Nobody has that, because Correa was, after all, he was the leader, he was the one in the president for those 10 years, nobody else. So that's always a problem when they take him out of the equation by making it illegal for him to even really be an Ecuador. Then of course they've created problems. But I think they can be overcome. I think she's running a good campaign, but, you know, we'll have to see what happens.
Well, coups and disqualifications, that seems to be the nature of a democracy generally these days. And it'll be interesting times anyway. The election is Sunday for the first ballot. When's the second ballot, Joe, assuming that Gonzalez doesn't make the threshold?
Yeah, if she doesn't win the first round, I think the second one is about 4 to 6 weeks later, if I recall correctly. I haven't checked the date. I haven't checked the date yet, but it's something like that.
Well, it's fascinating times, Joe, and troubling as well in Ecuador and the whole region and the whole world for that matter. But thanks a lot for coming on and giving us your view and your expertise, Joe?
Oh, thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
And I want to also thank Dimitri Lascaris and remind people to keep an eye on Gaza while all this other craziness is going on. The people there are still suffering as ever. Thanks again, Joe.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
Escape the Narrative. Guerrilla Radio.